C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and Flannery O'Connor are particularly rich sources for reflection, and time spent on them and their work is well rewarded. Just if I could ask quickly, how many of you feel like you've read a lot of C.S. Lewis? Tolkien? O'Connor? Oh, okay, so still a lot for O'Connor, but maybe the third place. That's okay. My own assignment this afternoon as a member of this panel is O'Connor, but I can't help but discuss her creative vision in relation to her fellow English Christians. Recently, I've been spending more time with Tolkien than with Lewis, and so I'm going to use some things that Tolkien says, principally in his essay on fairy stories, to develop two elemental features of Flannery O'Connor's Christian imagination. And I hope Professor Coons will forgive me a little bit for trespassing on his territory. One of those features she shares with Tolkien and Lewis, though I'm going to leave Lewis out of things for the most part, and it's arguably the most important characteristic of Christian literature. But the other feature she does not share with him. Indeed, if we were to compare her in this regard to another Catholic novelist who rewrote Old Norse tales, it would be to Sigrid Undset rather than to Tolkien. It's not my intention to argue that O'Connor is right or wrong to emphasize what she does over against someone like Tolkien. But if we're going to appreciate the work of these authors and understand what we might learn from them and what role they might play in our future, we should try to understand why they wrote as they did and what they might gain or give up as a result. For those of you who are only vaguely familiar with Flannery O'Connor, let me hazard the claim that of the three writers we're considering this afternoon, her star is brightest in our current, not particularly Christian, intellectual firmament. She's considered a serious writer of extremely rare talent, and she's read by all sorts of people as a master of her craft. Despite the enormous cultural appeal of Tolkien and Lewis, their popularity seems to me, at least for the moment, a different sort of thing. Before you start throwing some food up here at the front, let me just add that I leave it entirely open whether or not the Secular Academy is correct in its judgment. The massive Norton Anthology of Short Fiction, for example, a standard college doorstop, includes two of O'Connor's stories, a significant but not extraordinary achievement, but also includes her as one of only five authors treated in depth alongside Chekhov, Faulkner, Alice Munro, and Joyce Carol Oates. The long supplemental section includes extended biographical material, several of her nonfiction essays, critical appraisals of her work, and of all things, an excerpt from her recently published prayer journal. You could summarize the Secular Academy's sincere, though somewhat embarrassed, admiration with this comment from the writer and poet Elizabeth Bishop, writing to Robert Lowell about their common friend upon the appearance of her second novel. Here's Bishop. "Yes, the Flannery book is a bit disappointing, I'm afraid. One wishes she could get away from religious fanatics for a while. But just the writing is so damn good compared to almost anything else one reads. Economical, clear, horrifying, real." Born in 1925 in Savannah, Georgia, to Irish Catholic parents from upper-class Southern families, Mary Flannery O'Connor was a quiet, intelligent, quick-witted, and rather contrary girl. A writer from a young age, she caused a minor family scandal at the age of 10 by a collection of satiric and uncomfortably close-to-life vignettes titled simply, "My Relatives." It was in the naturalist vein, she wrote, and was not well received. Shortly before her 16th birthday, her father died of lupus, the disease that would one day claim her own life in 1964 at the young age of 39. After her father's death, she and her mother lived in the small town of Milledgeville, about 100 miles southwest of Atlanta. After attending the local women's college, she won a place at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, followed by a fellowship at Yadu, an artist's retreat in upstate New York. But after 5 years up north, lupus struck, and at the age of 25, she moved back to Milledgeville to live with her mother at Andalusia, the family dairy farm, where she would remain for the rest of her life. There at Andalusia, she would publish two novels and a generous handful of short stories, infused by her Southern Catholic sensibility. She was already and would remain a daily communicant whenever possible. And with an eye for hard-edged and eternal spiritual truths, she read widely, especially in theology, cutting her aesthetic teeth, as she would later say, on Jacques Maritain's Thomistic Art and Scholasticism. Accustomed to reading St. Thomas Aquinas each night before going to sleep, she wrote once to a friend that if my mother were to come in during this process and say, "Turn off that light, it's late," I, with lifted finger and broad, bland, beatific expression, would reply, "On the contrary, I answer that the light, being external and limitless, cannot be turned off. Shut your eyes." "I read a lot of theology," she said, "because it makes my writing bolder." The first elemental feature of O'Connor's work that I want to think about this afternoon is shared with Tolkien and Lewis, and is, as I've already suggested, the most important feature of Christian literature. When Tolkien was in the midst of writing The Lord of the Rings, he traveled to the University of St. Andrews in Scotland to deliver the 1939 Andrew Lang Lecture. Entitled On Fairy Stories, the lecture is Tolkien's most important published reflection on the nature of his own creative writing and on Christian fiction more broadly. At the end of this essay, Tolkien comes to the final characteristic of fairy stories, the consolation of the happy ending. "Tragedy," he says, "is the true form of drama, its highest function. But the opposite is true of fairy story. Since we do not appear to possess a word that expresses this opposite, I will call it eucatastrophe." You, not because it's your catastrophe, but because it's the Greek prefix for good, a good catastrophe. The you, here's Tolkien again, the you catastrophic tale is the true form of fairy tale and its highest function. Tolkien's here speaking of fairy stories in particular, in contrast with drama, or as he mentions elsewhere, the beast fables of Peter Rabbit, Gulliver's Travels, or the dream adventures of Alice in Wonderland. But eucatastrophe is of much wider application than the otherworldly fantasy Tolkien was describing. It's the mark, so I'd like to convince you all this afternoon, of Christian literature as such. The consolation of fairy stories, says Tolkien, the joy of the happy ending, or more correctly, of the good catastrophe, the sudden joyous turn, for there's no true ending to any fairy tale. This joy, which is one of the things which fairy stories can produce supremely well, is not essentially escapist nor fugitive. In its fairy tale or other world setting, it is a sudden and miraculous grace, never to be counted on to recur. It does not deny the existence of discatastrophe, or sorrow and failure. The possibility of these is necessary to the joy of deliverance. It denies, this is still Tolkien, it denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal final defeat, and insofar is evangelium, good news, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. Tolkien's reference here to evangelium is not accidental. As he says later, the eucatastrophe we see in a brief vision may be a far-off gleam or echo of evangelium in the real world. The Gospels contain a fairy story and the greatest and most complete conceivable eucatastrophe. The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the Incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. The joy of eucatastrophe is the precious joy that satisfies hope. And Christian literature is, above all, hopeful. This doesn't mean that a Christian story must end happily ever after. As O'Connor's fiction shows, a Christian story may be very grim indeed. But whatever tragic circumstances befall the characters, whatever pain and sorrow they must endure, the conclusion of a Christian story, if it does not clearly end in joy, at least leaves open the possibility of joy. As Tolkien says, it denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal final defeat. No suffering can extinguish every opportunity for redemption, not even, most of all, the cruel jaws of death itself. Dante's great epic of the afterlife is for this reason rightly called the Divine Comedy. Could we really suppose a reversal of Dante's narrative, where the reader begins with heaven, descends to purgatory, and ends up finally in hell, gazing on the three mouths of Satan? And Chaucer's retelling of the doomed love of Troilus and Cressida ends not with Troilus' death on the battlefield, but with the laughter of his soul as it rises over the earth and recognizes the pettiness of our worldly concerns in the presence of the eternal. There are as many ways to embody the hopefulness of the eucatastrophic in literature as there are authors who would make the attempt. But we would be hard-pressed to find a more pure expression of eucatastrophe than Flannery O'Connor's novels and stories. Dark as they seem, full of murders, sneering children, and trickster vagabonds, her fiction is nonetheless profoundly Christian, most of all because it is so hopeful. Despite the bloodshed, all of her characters and stories end with a eucatastrophe. And so all of them have, dare I say it, happy endings. Let's have a particular story before us. The River, an early story first published in 1953 when O'Connor was 28 years old, is one of two stories that end with a child's suicide. The other is The Lame Shall Enter First, written almost 10 years later towards the end of her life and first published in 1962 in the Swanee Review. The plot of The River is straightforward. And now I beg forgiveness from all of you. Those of you who know this story are going to be a little bored. Those of you who haven't read it, I'm afraid, are going to be a little shortchanged. But if you haven't read it, at least I hope I provoke you into reading it as soon as possible. Harry Ashfield, a boy 4 or 5 years old, is picked up Sunday morning from his house by Mrs. Conan, his babysitter for the day. She takes him to her house, half-mile walk from the end of the town streetcar line, where her three boys trick him into letting out a pig, who chases Harry, terrified, back to the house. Later that afternoon, Mrs. Conan takes Harry and her children down to the river, where an itinerant preacher is speaking to a small crowd. "Listen to what I got to say, you people," he says. "There ain't but one river, and that's the river of life, made out of Jesus' blood. That's the river you have to lay your pain in, and the river of faith, and the river of life, and the river of love, and the rich red river of Jesus' blood, you people. All the rivers come from that one river and go back to it like it was the ocean sea. And if you believe, you can lay your pain in that river and get rid of it, because that's the river that was made to carry sin. It's a river full of pain itself moving toward the kingdom of Christ, to be washed away slow, you people, slow as this here old red water river round my feet." Mrs. Conan suddenly brings Harry to the front and presents him for baptism. "You won't be the same again," the preacher says. "You'll count." Harry is thrust under the water and emerges spluttering while the preacher says, "You count now. You didn't even count before." When Mrs. Conan brings Harry home, his parents are in the middle of another evening party when the preacher earlier asks Harry about his mother's ailment so he can call on Jesus to heal her. Harry innocently replies, "She has a hangover." Harry's mother eventually comes in to say goodnight in order to ask what lies he'd been telling today. The next morning, he wakes up late, wanders around the apartment, eating odds and ends. Bored, he calculates that his parents will get up after 1 in the afternoon. Suddenly, he leaves the house, takes the streetcar out of town, returns to the river, where he wades in and, after a few unsuccessful tries, drowns himself. "For an instant, he was overcome with surprise," O'Connor writes. "Then, since he was moving quickly and knew that he was getting somewhere, all his fury and his fear left him." We could dull the sharp edge of this story by treating it as an allegory. O'Connor is clearly thinking about the way that baptism works, and especially the Catholic doctrine of baptism of desire. The story is full of images of death and the devil. Three times Mrs. Conan is called a skeleton, first a speckled skeleton, then a musical skeleton as she's falling asleep on the bus, and finally a woman who stares with a skeleton's appearance of seeing everything. And when Mrs. Conan, her children, and Harry make their way to the river, they look like the skeleton of an old boat. The preacher, for his part, has a face all bone and red light reflected from the river. The pig that chases Harry seems merely a malicious trick until we learn a few pages later that Mrs. Conan reads to Harry from an old children's book, The Life of Jesus Christ for Readers Under 12. I've been reading some of those, not from this particular book, but some of those to my kids in the last few months, and the story of Potiphar and Potiphar's wife and Joseph, they leave a lot of things out in those stories, in case you haven't had the experience. O'Connor writes, one of a carpenter, the book was full of pictures, one of a carpenter driving a crowd of pigs out of a man. They were real pigs, gray and sour looking. Gray and sour, two words that pick up the description of the Conan's all-too-real pig some pages earlier, who nosed its gray, wet, and sour face into Harry's. And as Harry is drowning himself, he sees the skeptic from yesterday's crowd, Mr. Paradise, bounding after him like a giant pig and shouting, trying, of course, to save Harry from the river. Attentive readers might then remember that Mrs. Conan herself made the comparison earlier, telling Harry that the pig he let out favors Mr. Paradise that has the gas station. He's got the cancer over his ear. One of the pig's ears had been bitten off. He always comes to show he ain't been healed. And as it happens, Mr. Paradise drives a gray car and wears a gray hat turned down over one ear and up over the other. The first piece of dialogue we get is the claim that Harry ain't fixed right. His arm is hung up in the sleeve of his coat. Well then, for Christ's sake, fix him, is the father's reply. An oath repeated later when, after Mrs. Conan announces to Harry's mother that the preacher prayed for her to be healed, she replies, healed? Healed of what, for Christ's sake? And his father says farewell that morning by saying, goodbye, old man. Perhaps a reference to the old man Adam of the Apostle Paul, who says in Colossians, do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his practices and have put on the new man, who is being renewed in knowledge after the image of his Creator. Harry himself is described as mute and patient, like an old sheep waiting to be let out. And he tricks Mrs. Conan into calling him by a new name, the name with which the preacher baptizes him. So we can ease the pain and shock of this story of a neglected little boy who drowns himself by reading the story as a dramatization in the trappings of the American South of the mystery of baptism. The symbolism's no doubt there, but I think we fail to do O'Connor justice if we take such an easy way out. The story has to work on a literal level as well as a symbolic one. Indeed, it can't work symbolically unless it also works literally. I find that readers sometimes react to this story on a literal level with something approaching horror. That is, the story must be a tragedy and describe some of the many ways we, both religious and secular, can fail our children. But, and I fear I've not conveyed this at all really so far, this story is without a doubt a comedy and not a tragedy. Who can resist the humor of Mrs. Conan's disdain for an abstract painting she sees on the wall of Harry's house? I wouldn't have paid for that, she says, nodding at the painting. I would have drew it myself. Reminds me, any of you know Olivia? The children's book, Olivia, fantastic Jackson Pollock riff in Olivia, just like this. Then a few paragraphs later, she gives the watercolor another look and concludes, I wouldn't have drew it. This story is a comedy, though, not just in the details, though its details are very funny, but as a whole, for it ends happily, doesn't it? If we take Christianity seriously, then little Harry makes his way to heaven by the last page, like Dante on the heels of Beatrice. Of course, we can respond that a little boy isn't supposed to get to heaven that way. Harry's ignorant, no doubt, and takes what the preacher says at face value, doesn't see that he's drowning himself. So we can't think of him as committing the sin of self-destruction. But wouldn't things have been better had they turned out differently? I suppose that must be true. Had his parents loved him properly, if we'd understood more of the world and the way Jesus wants to save us, he wouldn't have thought that the way to Jesus was downriver. There are all sorts of ways of imagining a better life and death for Harry. But what about the Harry that we see in this story? The little boy who just does have rotten parents and who knows little of the world and probably shouldn't look forward to learning much more of it anytime soon. This particular little boy, who might at any time be smitten by God's providence, struck by lightning, run over, overcome by illness, killed by any number of things that bring down thousands of people the world over every day. How exactly is this particular boy's death a tragedy for him? Assuming, of course, that the Christian religion is a true one, and that we should not expect Harry to be anywhere else than, surely, with Jesus that very day in paradise. Eucatastrophe indeed. O'Connor's stories abound with this kind of ending. Hazel Motes, the protagonist of her first novel, Wise Blood, made into a movie, by the way, 1979 by John Huston. Have you seen the movie? Just out of curiosity, a couple people. Okay. Worth watching, actually. That's pretty good. Hazel Motes dies of exposure, followed by a blow to the head, but only at the conclusion of a lengthy spiritual purification. The grandmother in A Good Man is Hard to Find, O'Connor's most well-known, I think, and anthologized story, is shot dead point blank at the end of a rather long day, but only after the grandmother's head cleared for an instant, she writes, after which the grandmother reaches out and touches the misfit, her murderer, on the shoulder. Speaking to an audience many years later, O'Connor said that she preferred to think that the old lady's gesture, like the mustard seed, will grow to be a great crow-filled tree in the misfit's heart, and will be enough of a pain to him there to turn him into the prophet he was meant to become. At the end of her life, the grandmother does the right thing in some sense, and so dies a good death. Ruby Hill, in A Stroke of Good Fortune, comes to the slow and terrifying realization that she is pregnant, but the reader is left with the clear impression that pregnancy is the best thing that ever happened to her. Three young arsonists set alight Mrs. Cope's woods in the conclusion to A Circle in the Fire, and that seems the only thing that could possibly shake Mrs. Cope out of her spiritual complacency. And even though Mrs. May ends Greenleaf, gored to death by a bull, she dies with the look of a person whose sight has been suddenly restored, but who finds the light unbearable. As bent over the bull, she appears to whisper some last discovery into the animal's ear. The story is, among other things, I think, a rewriting of Francis Thompson's The Hound of Heaven. Speaking of the violent exaggerations of her stories, O'Connor wrote, less than a year before her death in 1964, "A good story is literal in the same sense that a child's drawing is literal. When a child draws, he doesn't intend to distort, but to set down exactly what he sees. And as his gaze is direct, he sees the lines that create motion. Now, the lines of motion that interest the writer are usually invisible. They are lines of spiritual motion. And so in her stories, you should be on the lookout for such things as the action of grace," she says, "and not for the dead bodies." I've been describing O'Connor's stories as eucatastrophic, hopeful in the Christian eschatological sense. Each one ended in some fashion by a fierce encounter with God's grace. O'Connor's characters are broken, sinful people, but I think she loves them nonetheless, and she always offers them the chance of salvation. Her own way of explaining the hard, unyielding texture of her stories is most clearly presented in her essay, Some Aspects of the Grotesque, in Southern Fiction. Here's a marvelous passage, I think, towards the end, that's worth quoting in full. Everyone needs, of course, to be lifted up. There's something in us as storytellers and as listeners to stories that demands the redemptive act, she says, that demands that what falls at least be offered the chance to be restored. The reader of today looks for this motion, and rightly so, but what he has forgotten is the cost of it. His sense of evil is diluted or lacking altogether, and so he's forgotten the price of restoration. I'm often told that the model of balance for the novelist should be Dante, who divided his territory up pretty evenly between hell, purgatory, and paradise. There could be no objection to this, but also there can be no reason to assume that the result of doing it in these times will give us the balanced picture that it gave in Dante's. Dante lived in the 13th century, when that balance was achieved in the faith of his age. We live now in an age which doubts both fact and value, which is swept this way and that by momentary convictions. Instead of reflecting a balance from the world around him, the novelist now has to achieve one from a felt balance inside himself. There are ages when it is possible to woo the reader. There are others when something more drastic is necessary. O'Connor wrote as she did, if we take this paragraph seriously, because as a Christian, she needed to write hopeful fiction, fiction that held out at least the possibility of redemption. But to make such spiritual realities visible in stories that would work for her readers, she needed the tools of distortion, tools that resulted in fiction that is, as she calls it, wild, violent, and comic. And her hope that the grandmother would help the misfit become a prophet is no casual aside. She herself aspired to what she called prophetic vision. As she says, the novelist's prophecy is a matter of seeing near things with their extensions of meaning and thus of seeing far things close up. The river, like a cubist painting, in one sense distorts what it shows us, but only in order to make visible what is usually hard or impossible to see all at once. Although death is not as close to us for the most part as it is to the characters in O'Connor's stories, she would insist that it should be. In her preface to a memoir of Marianne, a Georgian girl who died from a facial tumor at the age of 12 after a life of obvious joy and peace despite terrible suffering, O'Connor wrote that the creative action of the Christian's life is to prepare his death in Christ. It's a continuous action in which this world's goods are utilized to the fullest, both positive gifts and what Père Teilhard de Chardin calls passive diminishments for suffering. I've been working through Flannery O'Connor's stories as compelling, maybe even pure, examples of hopeful, eucatastrophic Christian fiction. But O'Connor's explanation of the importance of the grotesque in her stories, the absence of wooing, and the focus on pain and one's preparation for death, will help me explain the second important characteristic of her work, one that sets her apart from Tolkien and Lewis. Tolkien's description of eucatastrophe appears in the concluding pages of On Fairy Stories. At the beginning of that essay, Tolkien remarks that it is a man who is, in contrast to fairies, supernatural, and often of diminutive stature. Whereas they, fairies, fairyland, they are natural, far more natural than he. Such is their doom. The road to fairyland is not the road to heaven, nor even to hell, I believe, though some have held that it may lead thither indirectly by the devil's tithe. There's something non-eternal, for good or ill, about fairyland, as if fairyland is about fairyland and not some other thing. O'Connor wants to pull into focus all the supernatural things tied to the everyday world of our senses, heaven and hell, angels and demons, sin and grace. Fairyland is content just with itself. Some pages later, Tolkien claims that fairy stories as a whole have three faces: the mystical towards the supernatural, the magical towards nature, and the mirror of scorn and pity towards man. The essential face of fairy is the middle one, the magical, says Tolkien. Again, Fairy itself may perhaps most nearly be translated by magic. Later, he switches to the word enchantment, and then fantasy. Or, as he elsewhere says, most good fairy stories are about the adventures of men in the perilous realm or upon its shadowy marches. Tolkien's threefold division into the mystical, the magical, and the mirrored is a useful one. Though any story having anything to do with any of these three will have at least something to say about all of them, Tolkien's right that certain kinds of writing, and so certain kinds of writer, focus on one or another of them. Tolkien clearly loved the magical, the enchanted, the fantastic, and the adventurous. If I could risk an extension of his vocabulary, I would say that he loved the pagan. By pagan, I mean all of creation, insofar as it dwells within itself, rejoicing in its own glorious splendor, even though aware at the same time of its own mysterious imperfection. Though the word pagan is not a central idea in On Fairy Stories, there's a suggestive passage written when Tolkien was a young man, in the midst of rewriting the tragic story of Kullervo, the Finnish pagan hero at the center of the Kalevala. Here's Tolkien. "The delight of the earth, the essential feeling as of the necessity for magic, that juggling with the golden moon and silver sun, such are they, that is man's universal pastime. These are the things to seek in the Kalevala. All the world to wheel about in, the great bear to play with, and Orion and the seven stars all dangling magically in the branches of a silver birch." But do not think here that Tolkien is somehow preferring the specifically pagan to the Christian. Here's Tolkien again. "There may be some whom these old songs will stir to new poetry, just as the old songs of other pagan days have stirred other Christians. For it is true that only the Christians have made Aphrodite utterly beautiful, a wonder for the soul. The Christian poets are those who, while renouncing their Christianity, owe to it all their feeling and their art, have fashioned nymphs and dryads of which not even Greece ever dreamt. The real glory of Latmos was made by Keats." For Tolkien, the true Christian can out-pagan the pagans. How so? By celebrating the exquisitely bittersweet beauty of everything around us in all its transient glory. Christians have the fullest possible appreciation of the splendor of the natural world because we know that God deigned to join it to himself in the person of his Son. The beauty of the sensuous, its tastes and textures, the songs of birds, the blues of the sky, the moist pungency of freshly turned earth. Even though Christians celebrate them even more than any pagan could, knowing that they come from God, just because they do come from God, they are worth joyfully celebrating, joyfully experiencing in their own right as things in themselves. I think this is the kind of joy Tolkien takes in the natural world, and that he tries to create anew in his invented worlds. As he says in On Fairy Stories, the primal desire at the heart of fairy is the realization, independent of the conceiving mind, of imagined wonder. C.S. Lewis is very much of one mind, I think, with Tolkien in all this. But Flannery O'Connor is interested in something else. The mystical face and the mirror of scorn and pity turned towards man himself are her primary interest. And while the magical is not entirely absent, how could any of the three ever be entirely absent? It's not where she concentrates her power. Instead, O'Connor always makes us see the inadequacy of the natural world, its impoverishment in contrast with the divine. While we are alive on this earth, we will suffer, for we are a pilgrim people. And we should not expect real joy before we die and rise again. On the contrary, like the early martyrs, should not we rather yearn to die, especially to die for Jesus? I've taken my title today from John Bunyan's allegory, The Pilgrim's Progress, written late 1600s, in which the main character says to Evangelist, his guide, "Sir, I perceive that I am condemned to die, and after that to come to judgment. and I find that I am not willing to do the first, nor able to do the second. Then said Evangelist in reply, why not willing to die, since this life is attended with so many evils? Is it not a mistake to linger over the good things of the earth? This place is not our true home, and its fruits will never satisfy us. Consider the river again and the language O'Connor uses to describe her characters and their world. I've already mentioned the gray and sour pigs, as well as the skeletal appearance of Mrs. Conan, the preacher, and the line of figures walking to the river. Here's how she describes the sun, an important character in almost all of her fiction, over the course of the story. First, there's the gray morning. Later, the white Sunday sun climbing fast through a scum of gray clouds as if it meant to overtake them. Later, it is rolling away ahead of them. When Harry's at the river, he sees the pieces of the white sun scattered in the river. And later, the air was so quiet he could hear the broken pieces of the sun knocking in the water. The next morning, the sun came in palely, stained gray by the glass. Finally, on his way up to the river for the last time, the sun was pale yellow and high and hot. The words lined up alongside sun, pieces, scattered, stained, glass, pale, and so on, clearly convey the omnipresent and penetrating power of the sun, rather than its beauty. The human characters, for their part, are glum and limp, looming, toneless, or jaunty, with collapsed mouths. That's a particular favorite expression of hers. They glance severely with eyes still and gray as glass and stern faces. The most common word describing speech, beside he or she said, is muttered. No one ever smiles, though now and again someone refrains from smiling, like the three boys who looked at Harry silently, not smiling. Instead, people grin, a word with many more layers of complexity than the word smile. Grin comes from the Old English grenion, by the way, meaning to bare the teeth in pain or anger. And it's probably related to the word groan. Curiously, it's also cognate with the Old High German grennen, to mutter. Might O'Connor have had this in mind? I don't know. I hope so. The tension O'Connor builds into this story by means of her vocabulary is so powerful that the reader, like Harry himself, feels the release of the final paragraph, where the language smooths out. The wading current caught him like a long, gentle hand and pulled him swiftly forward and down. For an instant, he was overcome with surprise. Then, since he was moving quickly and knew that he was getting somewhere, all his fury and his fear left him. It's quite simply impossible to imagine Tolkien's Middle-earth described in this way. O'Connor's stories are powerful in large part because they force us to confront our eternal destiny and to remember how little everything else matters in comparison. God's grace in her world is just like that long, gentle hand, pulling, always pulling us down and through this world and into the next. I mentioned earlier that if we were to compare O'Connor to another writer who rewrote Old Norse tales, it should be Sigurd Undset rather than Tolkien. For Undset, too, we are most of all pilgrims, and the central fact of pilgrimage is the struggle to get where one is going. Her two greatest stories, the trilogy Kristin Lovren's Daughter and Tetralogy, The Master of Hesviken, any of you read those by any chance? Just a couple of you. I highly recommend them to the rest of you. Which together, those two novels earned her the Nobel Prize in 1928. Both have lives of excruciating suffering as their centerpieces. Suffering that nonetheless, even though always self-inflicted, is eventually a channel of redemptive grace. Inspired at this time in her life by St. Augustine, Undset meditates on the goods of this earth as potential distractions from the one true good in which we might finally rest. It's as if both O'Connor and Undset see the ravishing beauty of created things and use their stories to remind us that we must always be on our toes, lest we linger too long and forget our journey. Like Christian in The Pilgrim's Progress, we might find ourselves in a pleasant arbor, made indeed by the Lord himself for the refreshing of weary travelers. But resting a while, we must take care lest we fall into a slumber, and thence into a fast sleep, and not awake until the day is far spent. O'Connor's prophetic voice cries out to us from the wilderness, "Make straight the way for the Lord." Her writing demands that we take our life seriously as a journey towards death and judgment. And as the preacher says to Mr. Paradise, glancing towards him with a raised fist, "Believe Jesus or the devil. Testify to one or the other." Tolkien, on the other hand, writes to woo us like a lover, offering the beauty and joy of his creations. It's true that these creations reflect supernatural divine realities. They too can be, or surely meant to be, means of ascent to beauty itself. But they can work in this way only if they themselves really are beautiful and so really are worth lingering over for their own sakes. They can be means of grace only insofar as they are also, at least potentially, near occasions of sin. I began by saying I would not judge between these two kinds of Christian writing, merely that I wanted to reflect on what each was in itself, what it cared about, what it had to sacrifice in order to achieve its own ends. O'Connor sacrifices, we might say, the soft, the musical, in her writing. She famously claimed to have the original tin ear. All I can say about it, she said, is that all classical music sounds the same, and all other music sounds like the Beatles. There's no place for her for lingering, I think, over the gentle beauty of nature, or the tender caresses of mothers for children, or lovers for beloveds. The most and perhaps only tender moment in the river comes just after Harry's mother has asked about his lies after his return home. After a second, she lowered him by his shirt front onto the pillow. She hung over him an instant and brushed her lips against his forehead. Then she got up and moved away, swaying her hips lightly through the shaft of light. We get only the lightest suggestion of real love sandwiched between her grip on his shirt front and a reminder of her sexuality. What O'Connor gains by all this is the immediacy, the seriousness of the battlefield. Sometimes Christians need prophets, and sometimes they need lovers. All of us, at one time or another, need both. I don't mean this as a claim that the Christian imagination of O'Connor can be simply harmonized with that of Tolkien, as if we just need a varied diet. I'll take a helping of Tolkien and Lewis with some O'Connor on the side, please. They are, to a certain extent, in real conflict with one another, one of those conflicts that is at the heart of Christianity. As Christians, we should long for death, since only then will we be with our Savior. But as Christians, we should long for life, since life is a gift from our Creator to be celebrated to the fullest. Such things are unavoidably mysterious as well as exhilarating, are they not? Thank you.
You'll see when I give my lecture that there's a lot of convergence of thinking. I guess I've tried to turn that into a question. I think you're right that what Connor emphasizes is what's not in Tolkien, and that it's a real problem that it's not in Tolkien. Mm. I say that as an incredible Tolkien fan. no one greater fan than I am, but I think you're right.
I am interested, actually. I have a feeling that some of the room leans more towards Tolkien,
yeah,
and some leans more towards O'Connor. So I thought you might say, yeah, I wish there were more Tolkien in O'Connor. Instead of, I wish there were more O'Connor in Tolkien. I think that's...
I mean, there is some O'Connor, just to say, besides that. I mean, there is something of the cross in Tolkien, too. I think Frodo and Sam's journey up the mountain,
yeah,
is a kind of a,
yes, pilgrimage. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not that Tolkien doesn't take suffering seriously,
right?
But even so, I mean, I think you're right. I think Tolkien would say, look, maybe this is a deep difference between the two. Tolkien thought that his stories couldn't be restatements of the gospel itself, that was somehow sacrilegious, right? And they want the gospel. Read the gospel. Don't read Tolkien, don't read O'Connor.
Yeah.
So that might be a criticism that he would make, is that O'Connor, in a sense, is trying to write the gospel again.
Mm.
And can that really be done?
There's in Leaf by Niggle, which I think responds to some of these concerns in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
Niggle's creation becomes part of the heavenly firmament itself in some way. And that's very interesting. That's not, you could string a kind of response out of that, I think, to the kind of uneasiness about dwelling on the earthly and forgetting about the heavenly.
Well, that whole story, I think, reflects a lot of self-doubt on Tolkien's part.
He
is Niggle, right? He spends his life doing something he thinks is often unsuccessful.
Right. I set this presentation up as to drive a strong contrast between the two, because I think it's a fruitful way of thinking about them. But to be fair to O'Connor, I mean, probably the natural world is at its most seductive in her stories when she's talking about birds, especially peacocks. There's something about those that she couldn't quite use as just a way of moving past the natural world.
She raised them, didn't she?
She did, absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They start showing up in her stories when she starts getting... As soon as she gets her first peacock, they start showing up all over the place. Yeah.
Let me put you on the spot. I'm taken with this idea of a eucatastrophe in Flannery O'Connor. I haven't read her short stories in some years, so I may have a distorted view of what they are, but I get the impression that there are a lot of stories that are not eucatastrophes except in a kind of a paradoxical sense. I'm thinking of the story of the woman is sitting in a doctor's office, a late revelation.
Yeah.
And she's saying all sorts of racist and terrible things.
Yes.
And this young woman who's kind of a nasty type.
Right.
A reader of books.
Right.
At one point explains and says, "Why don't you go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog?"
She throws the book at her. It's a marvelous. Can you imagine sitting in the doctor's office and all of a sudden a young person just throws a book at you?
Or there are other stories where, and I think that what comes out there is evil. You know, the kind of revelation of evil in multiple senses, but also, I mean, it's contextualized in the fact that all these people need grace, need to be redeemed. The girl who's too angry, the woman who's racially prejudiced. But there's no, I don't see that, I wouldn't describe that immediately as eucatastrophe, other than revealing reality.
Right.
I think there are other stories like that, too. The story of the woman who has the phony leg and the
Good Country People.
Yeah, the huckster steals her phony leg, and
yeah.
She says, I never believed in God. And he said, well, I ain't never believed in nothing.
I don't either. Yeah.
Yeah, so all of a sudden you find that Good Country People are bad country people. And they aren't maybe necessarily country. So there's a kind of a paradoxical way that these things reveal goodness and the possibilities of redemption, but I'm just curious if, because I haven't read them in so long, I can't remember how much of a percentage of that is there and how much the other thing that you're talking about is really.
So let me say something to the particular two stories you mentioned, which I think I can have convincing responses to those. But there are some other stories, actually, that are harder to make the case for. I take the eucatastrophic partly to mean that there's a moment of crisis, and that moment of crisis is an opening towards grace, a moment, an opportunity for redemption, for even for salvation. In both those stories, I think the examples you mentioned are applicable. So in Revelation, the woman, this is a college girl, throws the book. I think it's called Human Development. Great title. Throws the book, hits her right on the head, knocks her flat. And then whispers to her, you are a warthog from hell, as you said. Pigs. O'Connor's really interested in pigs. They come up all over the place. It's really interesting. But then she goes home, meditates on what she was told, has a kind of angry discussion with God. And the final page of that story is a vision she has, basically of Judgment Day and all the souls going to heaven. And the souls that she thinks, the souls that she's glad she's not, as a good hypocrite, all end up being in the front of the line. And then she sees all the people like herself, you know, who had a pretty good life and knew what to do with it. They're all at the end. She still sees herself on the way, though. I take it that at the moment of that, at the end of that story, she's gone through a kind of spiritual transformation. Now, partly what makes her stories, I think, accessible to non-Christians is that they're open. There's a kind of ambiguity to all the stories. A lot of people don't believe her when she says when the grandmother touches the misfit, it's a moment of grace both for the grandmother and for the misfit. They're like, no, you can't see your own story. But I think at least in her own intention, her own perspective on what she's doing, she sees that in Revelation as a moment of grace. I think it's the same thing for Good Country People. Good Country People, one of my favorite stories, because the main protagonist, Holga, is a philosopher. And that fake leg of hers is a symbol for her kind of self-sufficiency. And at the end of that story, what gets taken away from her is the part of her that was false, that was making her think she was whole when she actually wasn't. We get less of a development of her interior life at the end of that story, but I still think that the best thing that could have happened for her was for that Bible salesman to come by and steal her leg. Who knows what will happen next, but it might be better than what came before. Now, and this is a long answer, but the story that's most distressing to me is A View of the Woods. Any of you know that story? Yeah? That's a harsh story. At the end of that story, a grandfather murders his granddaughter, and he dies of a heart attack that is basically caused by his granddaughter before he kills her. So there's a lot of identity issues going on. The granddaughter looks like the grandfather and so on. It's the only child murder story that she wrote. That's harder. It's hard to see whether or not there's a moment of grace. For me, the very last line of that story, the grandfather who's consumed with material concerns the entire story and thinks of himself as completely self-sufficient. At the end of that story, he has a vision of himself wandering to the trees and looking for someone to help him. It's the first recognition, that self-recognition he's had of his neediness in the story. Now, does that mean it's possible that he ends up going to heaven instead of hell after a pretty bad life and just, you know, what a way to go at the end? I don't know. It's at least open. I'll put it that way.
Two questions, sort of. One, going back to Dr. Coombs' comment about Tolkien, I wonder if the difference that we see in how evil and the grotesque is treated is due to their different experiences of evil. So for Tolkien, going through World War I, yeah, it was a much different experience than O'Connor growing up in America. And then the second question is, I wonder if you elaborate more on the very beginning of your talk where you said that O'Connor's light is shining brightest right now in some ways for our present moment.
Yeah. Okay, let me say something first about their own lives. Tolkien would say it's dangerous to extrapolate from people's biography to their writing, and to the meaning of their writing, and O'Connor would say the same thing. Nevertheless, I can't resist thinking in that way, and I think we at least help ourselves ask the right kinds of questions when we think about their biography and the kinds of writing that emerged from it. Now, you're absolutely right that Tolkien saw a great deal of very serious suffering, World War I. Many of his very close friends died in that war. But I think it would also be a mistake to think that O'Connor doesn't experience a great deal of suffering also. Her suffering's different. She I think she's lonely for a lot of her life. She has a great, any of you had a chance to look at her letters, she has a very rich life through correspondence and a lot of many, great many number of friends. But she dies young. She's 39. She has an incurable disease for most of her adult life. She's very limited. She, if any of you know the Enduring Chill story of hers, in which a lot of her stories have autobiographical features in them, the Enduring Chill is about a southern boy who goes to New York City and then gets sick and comes home. That's her life, in a sense, and she's working through the anxieties that that creates for her. In a sense, part of her thought she was escaping the South, and then she comes back because she's sick, lives with her mother, which is a difficult relationship for her. She loved her father very deeply. She loved her mother too, but her relationship with her mother was more strained. I think I sometimes wonder if she would have been a different writer if her father had lived beyond her 16th birthday. That's an interesting question. So she too has a great deal of suffering in her life. How might that influence how they respond to it? I'm not sure. I think, at least, let me say one, I'll speculate one, say one speculative thing about their past. Tolkien lived through an intense moment of suffering. And for the rest of his life, in large part, tries to seize the beauty of the world as best he can, I think. Both the natural world and the created world, the artistic world. O'Connor lived with intense suffering most of her life, almost every day. Even as a child, her father was basically dying when she's an early teenager for over several years. So her experience of suffering is much more intense over a long period of time, I think, than it is for Tolkien. It doesn't answer your question, I don't think, but maybe it helps us ask other questions.
So if we just take like the Lord of the Rings, for example, the way evil manifests itself in the Lord of the Rings, there are like particular characters we might say are like more evil in some sense, but it's more of this ambiguous global force. And it's looming. It's more interested in, you might say, geopolitics. Like this experience of what war and evil would look like for his particular intense moment.
Tolkien should be read in international relations courses.
We read Dostoevsky for my international relations.
Perfect.
But with Flannery O'Connor's short stories especially, they're very particular. Individual people, individual idiosyncrasies, family relationships.
Right.
And I think that seems to come out of her own experiences of her suffering, of how she experiences the daily grind of suffering. We don't get elaborate battles. We don't get this global force of evil of something booming over the horizon as much, it seems.
Right. That's good. In Tolkien for most of his life was pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, the life of an Oxford Don is a very good one.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't answer your second question.
Right, it's the very beginning you're talking about.
The very beginning. Oh, about her presence.
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. I don't think people have yet come to terms with the seriousness of Tolkien's writing, his fiction. I think there's a lot more going on in his fiction than is obvious on the surface. Let me give you an example. There's a friend of mine, a philosopher at Notre Dame named David O'Connor, who has been thinking quite a lot about Tolkien recently. And he's connecting the vision of Lothlorien to some poetic movements in the 19th century. That is, he thinks of Tolkien as in the tradition of the Pre-Raphaelites, and that there are things that Tolkien is doing intellectually that are underneath the surface. I think in this regard, Tolkien's immense popular success has just been an obstacle. How can something that the people like be intellectually meaningful? You know? I mean, that's a problem we face, I think, as a culture. Yes?
So, I personally tend more towards Lewis and Tolkien, and I have tried to read O'Connor and read and reread, and every time I walk away with that tinniness in my mouth, and it's like there's this distaste.
Yeah.
And when comparing the two authors, it seems, when you look at the aspect of grace, it seems one is what you're saved from versus what you're saved for.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost I guess my question is that brutality necessary? That raw brutality that O'Connor uses and she relishes almost.
Yeah.
Yes, there's the reality of all of these things that you do have to face, and I think she's a genius at it and then presenting it. But I guess, how does she approach the mystery? I mean, is that even a consideration for her?
Say a little more. Can you say a little more though about that last line? Why'd you use the word mystic?
I guess because she does, Grace, it is, I mean, there is mysticism involved with that, but she tends to focus, I feel like she focuses more on the here and the now, and Tolkien does not. Like, he does, but I don't know how to explain this. I guess my first question is that brutality necessary, that raw brutality that she uses?
Right.
Why is it necessary? Why did she feel it was necessary? And then I guess my second question would be, how would she or does she even approach the mysticism of Bruce? Is there a mysticism or is it just this raw truth?
I think she thinks she has to write with brutality because that's what we need today. I'm not sure she's right about that.
That's what I'm struggling with.
In my remarks, what I want you all, part of the thing I'm trying to convey is that if thinking about this difference between O'Connor and Tolkien is right, there really is a kind of significant difference at the bottom. It's not difference that we can easily smooth over. I mean, if you are a Christian, then you should want to die, right? I mean, why would you want to linger here? Don't you want to be in heaven as soon as possible? There's got to be some force to that consideration.
Right?
Of course, yeah. I mean, we're all familiar, we should be, I hope, familiar with this thought that we want to die. We don't want to be here. We want to be in our true home. If you can feel the force of that thought, that very Christian thought, then I think you can feel the force of what O'Connor's doing. O'Connor kind of wants to strip away your attachment to the present world and to remind you over and over, to shock you into remembering that you shouldn't be attached to all these things. Something else matters more. Now, I think that leaves her open to certain problems too, right? Do you want to shock somebody into Christianity, or do you want to attract them to Christianity? Now you said the mystical. The reason I asked you to say a little bit more about the mystical is because O'Connor sees herself as most interested in the mysterious. Mm-hmm. And so the mystical. And even when Tolkien talks about the faces of fairyland, the mystical and the mirror, the one where we see ourselves, the mirror that reflects ourselves, and the mystical that brings us onto the supernatural. She would take those to herself, I think. You could take your thought in this direction and say, well, I don't see where O'Connor sees a place in human life for a kind of mystical achievement.
More of I guess that's more of...
Right? Where's St. Therese of the Cross and her... Where's the mystical union in the spiritual life that exists during a lived life and not after you're dead in O'Connor's writing? Mm-hmm. There's some of it there, I think, in Tolkien, probably. Mm-hmm. Where is it for O'Connor? It's not there. That sort of thing is not there. And I think for her, she would say, well, even the most exquisite mystical contact you can have in this life is never something that in any way comes close to heaven. I mean, you shouldn't think it does. That's not what you should aim for. You should aim for heaven. And if you get a little bit of mystical delight by the way, and you're still alive, so much better. Yes?
So I was wondering how you would consider how O'Connor sort of deals with the tension between death as a deprivation over which Jesus himself wept, and also death as in, you know, like, we're hoping for a perfect end. It's like,
yeah.
It seems like, I mean, do you
Is thinking of Lazarus?
Yeah.
Okay.
But is there an example of which, like, where grace is rejected in O'Connor's work? Is it seen as in, like, there's a possibility in which our souls are locked in to their, you know, wickedness or whatever? Or
like, is there anyone clearly damned in O'Connor's story? Is that maybe the thought?
Yeah, I guess. Like, so, like, because death is, you know, there's always the option for grace. But do you think, like, O'Connor engages with death, like, in its, like, without, like, redemption?
Okay. Well, let me start with the Lazarus thought. I think I have something to say to that. And then if you want to come back and follow up, we can keep thinking about this. If I'm understanding you correctly, when you mention Lazarus, the question would be something like this. How does O'Connor think about the real regret over the loss of life that Jesus seems to express in the gospel? Jesus acknowledges that losing your natural life could be a bad thing, and wants to retrieve somebody, and raises Lazarus. Okay, how does O'Connor think about that? To my knowledge, I mean, I've read most everything that she's published or that has been published, written by her. And I don't know of any direct engagement with that. In her novels and stories, there's no meditation on the genuine Christian pain of the loss of somebody's life. I don't think so. It's an interesting point to dwell on. Now, I mean, O'Connor could come back to the Lazarus thing and try to finesse it and say, well, I mean, that was before Christianity, properly speaking. They weren't entirely sure there was a resurrection. It's not clear that Lazarus was going to a heavenly home rather than something worse than his life. And so Jesus is working within, the Jewish people as he finds them before Christianity has been developed and established. But I'm sensitive to the larger thought, and that is that within Christianity, there just are these two things. There's the desire to die and to be with God, and there's the desire to live and to celebrate his gift to us. I don't see any way of just making that nice and tidy. If you think of one, please.